Okay, so you guys should have some handouts, and there's some really important questions that we'll be answering there. But the first one is, what is a worldview? And this is where I'd like to open it up to you guys and get some interaction going. Can anybody try to tell me what a worldview is? How can you define worldview? I wish I had Jeopardy music. I'm sorry, who was that? The way you view the world, yes. That is basically it. Would you mind maybe giving some elaboration on that? What do you...
Your perspective on things,
that's very good. Does anybody have anything to add to that?
Well, throughout the world, different cultures actually have different worldviews, and within those cultures, there's actually, you know... basically say subcultures, and they all believe in their own different things. Some people believe in goats and llamas and cows. And some people believe some people believe in God. Some people believe in spaceships and aliens.
Yeah.
Some people believe there is no God. Some people believe you just live the way you want to live, and you got your life, and that's all you got.
Okay.
So there are different types of worldviews. You know, it's kind of hard to define what is a worldview, because worldview is that person's actual opinion of, you know, their worldly view.
Yeah. So. Yeah, good point.
So a worldview sets a foundation for all that you will agree with or oppose or support or believe in.
It sets the foundations for all you will... Say that again, those all you will... Paints a picture. Okay, yeah. Really good. Right, right.
Not accepting that, but we will accept Buddha, and as long as, you know, you are tolerant of other cultures and beliefs, I think that is the worldview of the United States.
So you're talking about a specific worldview.
Global, we accept everybody's mm-hmm. beliefs, you know.
Inclusivism.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, everybody's included, except the ones we disagree with.
Right.
So, yeah, these are all really good answers, and they're all correct answers, I would say. I guess if you want to have maybe something, a little soundbite, I have here, which is written in the James Sire book, The Universe Next Door. He defines worldview as a set of presuppositions. A presupposition is basically assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false. So it's a worldview is a set of presuppositions which we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently, or inconsistently about the basic makeup of our world. And just like Lowell mentioned, it sets the foundation for the way, as Kristen mentioned, the way you view the world. So let me repeat that for those of you still writing. It's a set of presuppositions, which are assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, which we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic makeup of our world. And I guess an analogy to make this, you know, solidify this a bit more is, like I have here, a pair of sunglasses, right? So I view you in a certain perspective. I have all these colors coming at me, all these different frequencies of light, and they're hitting me, and I view you at a certain from a certain perspective, and you guys are viewing me at a certain perspective. But once I put these guys on, these sunglasses, all of a sudden, my view of this classroom has changed dramatically. And especially when I go outside, when the sun is bearing down on my face. The world is a lot darker, a lot gloomier, a lot uglier. I'm kidding. You guys are fantastic. You guys are all pretty. But I definitely have a much different view, and I will act in accordance with what I see. So it's definitely going to change the way I behave, the way I think, what I agree with, what I oppose. And so now you can see whatever is coming through these glasses, it's being filtered, right, through my worldview, which is, think about it as a pair of glasses. Everything I'm taking in, all the data that I'm taking in every second of the day is being filtered through my basic assumptions in my mind. And that is going to determine how I act, how I speak, how I think. Now, I liked what James Sire also mentioned. He says, you know, worldviews are generally unquestioned by each of us, rarely, if ever, mentioned by our friends, and only brought to mind when we are challenged by a foreigner from another ideological universe. So, you know, a lot of us really don't talk about our worldviews. We just assume, you know, we're all in a church. Obviously, we agree on a lot of things. But, you know, unless we start asking those deeper questions, we may not know what really our worldview is. So our worldviews generally go unquestioned, rarely if ever, until we go and directly question or ask these deeper questions about what our basic assumptions are. Now, I want to let you know, how does a worldview operate? How does a worldview operate? How does it work? And I gave you a little hint using the sunglasses here, but let me share what I was reading in another book here. This author wrote that images and information constantly wash over us via high-definition TVs, high-speed internet, 4G smartphone networks, and Facebook updates. All of these are mediums for constant messages which necessarily flow out of different worldviews that, for good or ill or bad purposes, they have a huge influence on us individually and culturally. Every person filters the information that enters their minds and their daily experiences through their worldview. Then they make sense of this information and their experiences based on their worldview. This process is automatic, and over time, the filtered information shapes their beliefs and influences how they function in society, including the smallest decisions they make. So as I mentioned, all the data that you're getting on a second-to-second basis is being filtered by your basic assumptions. And it's automatic. We rarely question it. But it's going to influence you over time. So whenever you hear a friend say, "My, you've changed." "Oh yeah, my worldview changed." Yeah, you can add that. Well, lest you are fearful that, "Oh my gosh, am I born with my worldview? Am I forever stuck in the current worldview that I have?" No. You were definitely influenced. We're babies. We are influenced by our environment, where we go to school, who we talk to, what we watch on TV, as we mentioned, what we're looking on Facebook, what we hear on the radio, everything, all the data. We're influenced, whether we like it or whether we like to believe it or not. We're influenced by all these things. But that does not mean that you cannot change it. You can change your worldview. But as I mentioned, your worldview development starts when you are very, very young. So some of us are very rooted in our current worldview. And that means that it will, if you desire to change your worldview, it will take time. And it will take a lot of reflection. It's going to take a lot of effort. But the key is to remain open-minded, to remain open to the truth, to remain open to where the evidence leads you. And that is the key to always having for lack of a better phrase, a correct worldview, something that is closer to reality, okay? This leads us to our next question, is why are worldviews significant? And I think it's pretty obvious from what I've already mentioned, since it affects our beliefs, right? But let me put it in a much more structured form here. Like I mentioned, it affects our thinking and behavior. Now, right off the bat, you got to know that's very important to us. Our thinking and our behavior. This is the way we're presented to the outside world. This is the way we're presented to our family, to our friends, to our employers. This affects us greatly. Now, I can put it in this soundbite form. Our worldview informs our belief system, and our beliefs inform our thoughts, feelings, and life experiences. And those are what form our actions. That's how we now go and start behaving in the world. So think of a pyramid, okay? You have your worldview as the foundation, your basic assumptions as the foundation, and then above it you have your beliefs. Your worldview informs your beliefs, and then your beliefs start informing your thoughts, your thought process, the way you start thinking, and then at the end you turn these beliefs, thought process, into action. And so that's the way you start living. Okay? Now, of course, you got to see this will impact, how it can impact an individual in a general sense. I mean, think about it. Think about your beliefs about morality. Think about your beliefs about life after death, or even the meaning and purpose of life. So if you think, for instance, if your basic assumption is that there is no God, and, you know, I was brought to this current time and place through Darwinian evolution, then that will definitely inform the way you believe, especially about life after death and about morals. It's impossible to have true objective morality if life, if matter is all there is, if there is no God who gives meaning and value and purpose to life. It's impossible to think about life after death if you're just a bunch of carbon atoms. There's nothing. You're just going to become carbon atoms on the ground. That's it. And also meaning and purpose in life. There is, you're a nihilist at that point. There is no meaning and purpose if you're just a bunch of matter, right? So you can see how it will definitely impact the way you view the world and also your interactions, your relationships that you build. Do they have meaning? Can you actually, are your assumptions matching up with reality? They're going to impact you. So you can see definitely it plays a really great role. It has a great influence in the way you believe. And that's why they're significant, guys. So think of all of us in here, the way we act on a day-to-day basis. What's informing? What's influencing us? How am I filtering my data? What big questions do I ask when I have to make even the smallest of decisions, or especially the big decisions of life? I did want to add this little caveat, this little note that will hopefully give us some caution about why we need to start thinking more and more about the worldviews that we're being exposed to, especially by the media, especially by our home life, or even the worldviews that we're promoting in our own, through our own behaviors and thoughts. Check out what this author said. Christians must understand the clash of worldviews that is changing the face of American society, and we must stand ready to respond as people grow disillusioned with false beliefs and values, and as they seek real answers. We must know not only what our worldview is and why we believe it, but also how to defend it. We must also have some understanding of the opposing worldview and why people believe them. Only then can we present the gospel in language that can be understood. Only then can we defend truth in a way that is winsome and persuasive. So if we want to go and evangelize people on the streets or even in our own families, and we don't know a lick about what their basic assumptions are, it's going to be very, very difficult to persuade them to think about a different worldview. Because remember, the worldview is your basic assumption. You're basically asking them to change their complete way of thinking. You're talking, if, so some of us, I'm 28, so there's some 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds. We're talking about influences that long in the making. And so when you're asking a person, hey, why don't you consider this entirely different set of beliefs and assumptions to replace yours that you've built up in the last 40 or so odd years? Really? You want me to do that from 1 minute to the next? I don't think so. So we have to have good reasons for why we believe, why we have our own worldview, but then we also have to be knowledgeable about the different worldviews that are out there. And so, guys, I cannot emphasize enough, it is very important to really have a good grasp on what is going on currently in the state of worldviews as it is happening on a global level. We must understand what is going on in the culture around us. How is the culture thinking? What questions are they asking? What answers are they giving? And do we have good answers in response to that? Okay, so with that said, this author goes on to say, you can see the struggle of worldviews play out in the media, at the movies, and in the classroom. As I mentioned, the language of conflict and struggle is no overstatement. This is really important. For as sociologist James Hunter points out, the ideas that shape the cultural elites shape the next generation. Let me repeat that. The ideas that shape the cultural elites shape the next generation. The struggle over the ivory tower is significant for the contemporary culture war for the simple reason that its outcome will ultimately shape the ideals and the values as well as the categories of analysis and understanding that will guide the next generation of American leaders. So he's talking about America in specific. And so as Cassandra was pointing out, is that there's a lot of things happening in levels that we can't even touch. The cultural elites who are making big decisions, but they're making these big decisions based on, a lot of the times, a bad worldview, an incorrect worldview. And that's where we come in, guys. As ministers, as people who have been given the ministry of reconciliation, as people who have been called to go out and make disciples, that is part of our job, is to go and influence the people who will be then rising up these ranks to the cultural elites, and we want them to have a correct worldview so that they can make influences in society that will represent Christ in a good manner. Okay? Now we get to the nitty-gritty. What are the worldviews that are out there? This is the fun part, guys. Now, I do want to mention before, I do want to preface that I'm going to mention the worldviews and we're going to describe them briefly, but we don't have enough time to get in depth on all of them. But I just want you to be aware of them. These are definitely worldviews that you will come across frequently, and we'll give a brief description, but just mind you that we will not get into an in-depth analysis. So here we go. By the way, I got the list of the worldviews from this awesome book here, Baker Encyclopedia of Christian Apologetics. It's like it says, this encyclopedia has a bunch of topics, and I looked up worldviews, and there it was. It gave a good synopsis, and it gave a good list, and so a lot of what you hear was found in that book. So here we go. I'm just going to list them out. You guys can fill in the blanks, and then after I list them, we'll go one by one, kind of give a brief overview of them. So in order, the first one is theism. Theism. T-H-E-I-S-M. All these are isms, by the way. They all end in I-S-M. Theism is the first one. The second is deism. D-E-I-S-M. The third is atheism. A-T-H-E-I-S-M. The fourth is pantheism. P-A-N, theism. P-A-N, theism. The fifth one, don't get confused with the fourth, is panentheism. Panentheism, P-A-N-E-N, theism. The sixth is finite godism. Finite godism. Don't be scared of the terminology here. We'll go through and break it down. Finite godism. The seventh is polytheism. Like polygon, not poly pocket, polygon, polytheism, one L. All right, now let's go back to the first one, which is theism, and let's give a brief overview. Theism, this worldview underneath will have the basic belief that there is an infinite personal God that exists beyond and in the universe. I'll repeat that. Theism believes that there's an infinite personal God that exists beyond and in the universe. Now, I'll ask you guys, does this sound familiar? It should. And I'll mention it why, but Let me expound some more here. Theism also believes in the personal nature of God, but also that the physical universe, everything around us, the cosmos here, the planet Earth, everyone around us here, the physical universe, as far as we can see in the telescope, is not all there is. So even as far as we can look in the telescope, God is beyond that. He is outside of the universe. He is the creator of the universe. So the physical universe is not all there is. I remember looking at the National Enquirer when I was a little kid, and I looked, and they had the picture like, has been found using a telescope. And then they drew a picture. It's like a oval. This is the universe. And then over here was like heaven. It was just like a big castle. Yeah. National Enquirer, those guys. Creators of Bat Boy. Okay. Also in theism is that God created the universe. Created. Okay. He also sustains the universe. So he keeps it going. Every second, every nanosecond of the day. But he also, he also acts in it in a supernatural way. So just because God created the universe does not mean that he can go and act in it. It doesn't mean that he's limited and he's like, oh, I can't touch it. It's my creation. I can't touch it or I'll mess it up. No, he can supernaturally act inside of his creation. So the reason it sounds familiar is because there are actually three big religions that are theistic religions. Of course, we have Christianity. We believe in the one God who is the creator and sustainer and the miracle worker inside of the universe. But, of course, we grew out of Judaism. So Judaism also believes in one God. So they're theistic or monotheistic. They believe in one God. But then you also have Islam. Islam believes that there is only one God. And that he's also the creator and sustainer and miracle worker inside of the universe. So that's theism, guys. Now let's go to deism. Deism says that there is a God beyond the universe, but not in the universe. He does not work in the universe. There's a big word that's used for that. It's called immanent. God is not immanent. That means he cannot be revealed or detected within the universe. And so it's basically theism, the first one, without miracles. That's all it is. A deist would say, God created the universe, he wound up the clock, and he said, go, and the universe was created, and then he just kind of left it alone. He's like, okay, I'm taking my lunch break. But then he never came back. And so he wound it up, and it was able to grow, and it keeps on growing, and we're here today. But we're never going to hear from him again. And there's no way that we can detect if there's a God. So somehow we know that he created it, but we can't detect him. You know, so it's theism minus miracles. And believe it or not, we find an example of this in the Bible. I believe it was the Sadducees who did not believe in miracles. And so you see Jesus when he debated about them about the resurrection, because they didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in miracles. So they were deists. They believed in a God, but they didn't believe in the miracle aspect of it. So these are deists. And there's no religion that really holds to this. It's more like a state of mind. It's just like, oh, I believe in a God, but there's no religion that's centered around deism. So just for your information. Now, you hear this a lot on the streets. I wanted to mention that. You'll definitely see the people that do believe in a God, but then they're like, oh, well, I don't believe all those miracle stories. But at least they claim not to believe it. But you question them a little bit more, and of course the truth comes out. The next one, guys, is atheism. This is my personal favorite here. Atheism says that there is no God. So no God exists beyond or in the universe. God is a meaningless term to them. It's not so much that they just don't believe in a God, so that means, that implies that there could be a God or that there is a God. They just choose not to believe in him. They literally say, it literally means, atheism means no God. So no God exists. And the reason I mention that is because there's a little wordplay that atheists today will use when you ask them, so why are you an atheist? Like, oh, I just don't believe in a God. Well, that's not what atheism means. Well, it does mean that to me. Well, no. Don't let them get away with that. Atheism means there is no God, and so they have to provide some evidence for that claim. But I digress. They believe that, an atheist would believe that the physical universe, capital U, the universe then becomes their God, because the physical universe is all there is. Okay? It's just matter in motion. As Carl Sagan said, I believe, I'm probably going to mess this up really, really bad, but he said the cosmos is what there were. Is what there was, is, and always will be. The cosmos, space, time, everything, the universe. That's all there is, was, and ever will be. Atheists nice little tidbit here is they become very vocal minority ever since 9/11. And you can tell why. You know, prior to that, they just saw religion as kind of like a joke, you know, but it really didn't influence anybody. There wasn't really anything wrong with it. But of course, now when you have planes flying into towers and into buildings, all because of a certain worldview that brought them to do that, now they become very vocal and say, ah, religion is poison. Religion poisons everything. We must stamp it out. And so they're very vocal minority. We hear, if you watch the news much or read the newspaper, you'll see a lot of topics being thrown around between the clash between religion and government and religion and science and stuff like that. And you'll see the atheists groups behind a lot of these discussions. And especially in the universities, there's many top-notch scientists who are in influential positions. And of course, there's also good theists that are also in influential positions. But the atheistic science professors and scientists, they are very vocal. They can be very vocal. And so it's good to raise up good people that go to universities that can match them at their level. Anyways, the next one is pantheism. This worldview believes that God is a frying pan. God, no, just kidding now. God is not a frying pan. This worldview comes from, you break it down into two parts. Pan means all. A-L-L, all. And then theism, God. So that means that all is God. So everything around you is God. You and I are God. The chair is God. This column is God. These lights are God. My hair on my arm is God. Everything is God. So God has manifest itself in these various ways, these various manifestations. So even you can break it down into atoms or quarks. All those things are God. So somehow these elements have divine qualities of some sort. But that's all it means, guys. Pan equals all, theism, God. All is God. Some forms of pantheism will believe that God is a force that is in all things. You guys ever see the movie Avatar? Where it was Gaia, who was the living force that was in nature, and it was, promoting its will. You know, when they were trying to figure out, should I kill this person or not? And then it would light up. That was the force that was speaking to them. Or maybe you've seen Star Wars. The force is strong with this one, right? That's pantheism. The force. What's that?
It was midichlorians. What's inside the force?
Yes. He knows all. Okay. I've lost you. No, but an interesting implication of this, an interesting outgrowth of this, is that because all is God, that means God is limited to the universe. God is limited to the universe, and so that means that I wrote down here, the goal in pantheism really is to become absorbed into the universe. And since there's only matter, that means that there's no such thing as morality. There's no such thing as truth. Even reality, pantheists will say, is an illusion. All these things that you experience is just an illusion until you die. And usually it includes karma, rebirth. You die and your goal is to be absorbed into God, or everything, the universe, basically. So that's an interesting implication there. The next one, guys, is panentheism. We know that pan equals all. And now we have a new prefix or some sort of fix here. N means in. E-N equals I-N. In. And theism equals God. So now we have all in God. All in God. And this one's these are a little, tough to kind of comprehend. And so I'll try to break it down as best as I can. But a good analogy here is God is in the universe as a mind is in a body, or a soul is in a body. So think of us. We believe that we are souls and that we have a body here on this earth. And so there's this codependency, right? My mind is causing my physical arm to move. You know, I can actually have physical effects here in this universe, and that's my mind causing a physical effect. But not also that, also included with that is when my body is not functioning well. For instance, when I catch a cold, my mind has, I can operate, but not to my fullest potential. So there's this codependency. So think also of a brain dead person, a mind that is dependent upon the physical body. If you're brain dead, you can't do anything. So there's that codependency. So God is in the universe, just like you would think a mind or a soul is in a body. And what happens when you believe in such a worldview is that the world, since the world is always changing, and God, or all, is in God, and God is in all, that means that God is always changing. So, you know, we believe, I believe it's in Hebrews, or maybe Timothy, probably Hebrews, where God is changeless. God does not change. That's theism. But here in panentheism, God is changing. God learns. You know, whenever we grow and develop and gain more knowledge, so does God. Because God is all, and all is God. A good analogy to see, another good analogy is to view God as a seed and also a tree. The tree would represent everything that God could possibly become. So that's the ultimate goal. The seed wants to become the tree, or has to become the tree. But then you could also view the seed, which represents the actual state that God is in now. So think of all your experiences and knowledge that you have now. Add those up. That's God. So add them up globally and universally. God is in that state. He's a seed and he's becoming the tree, right? But the tricky thing is that God can never actualize into the tree, because the world is always changing. The universe is always changing. Stars are blowing up. Stars are forming. Galaxies are forming. Black holes are forming. Everything's changing. I changed my mind 3 times right now. God's changing. He can never actually become the tree. So it's an infinite potential to become. But keep in mind, just bit, when you break it down, all is God. So again, it suffers the fate of pantheism, where you're just limited to the universe. And so there's no real grounding for morality or truth, stuff like that. Well, the second to last one, guys, is finite godism. Finite godism. Finite godism is a worldview that believes that God exists beyond and in the universe, but that God is limited in his nature, or its nature, and its power. Of course, we have that word finite. Compare that with infinite, right? Infinite means that there is no end. But finite, it's limited. We know this. So God is limited in nature and power. Now, why would you want to believe in a God that is limited? I mean, if you know, when you always pick, whenever somebody asks you, what superhero power would you have? You always pick the best one in your mind, right? Why would you want to pick a God that is finite? Well, it's really reactionary. This worldview came about trying to answer the problem of evil. Why does evil exist in the world? Well, since evil exists, that means that God is either not loving, or he probably doesn't have the strength to take care of evil, to get rid of it. So that's really a reaction to this problem of evil. Well, God must be limited in nature, but I won't blame him for it. I'll just become a finite godist. That's it. Last one, guys, is polytheism. Polytheism. So when you have a polygon, what does that mean? Many-sided, right? Many. Polytheism, many gods. That's what you believe there. Poly equals many, theism, gods. So obviously they believe that many gods exist beyond the world and in it. So it's like theism times infinity, or however many gods you want. But interestingly enough is that these many times when you ask a polytheist, their gods are finite, obviously. Think of Mormonism. Everyone has the potential to become a god, but it's interesting because their gods can be created. So God is not infinite at that point. So that's a big difference there. finite gods with their own domain, their own habitation, stuff like that. Ancient Greeks believed this, and we have Mormonism as a worldview that pertains to his worldview. And so that wraps up the basic overview of these worldviews. But now, I want to make a distinction here between two pieces of terminology. And I wrote down here, you know, while hearing about these worldviews, you may have thought some were just plain weird. Okay? But you have to remember, you're in America. There's other places that exist other than America. So even when you go to Middle East or South America, Africa, Asia, Antarctica even, ask a penguin or something, you know, you tell them about these worldviews, and some of the ones that you thought were weird, they won't even bat an eye. They're like, yeah, that's my worldview. So you have to remember, these worldviews are real. These worldviews exist. They're influential. A lot of people ascribe to some of these worldviews that you may think are weird. With that said, you may be kind of fidgeting and be like, well, does that mean, you know, how do we know which one's true? How can I tell if something makes sense or not? Well, that's where I want to bring two words, introduce you to two words, plausibility and credibility. Now, I'm going to make a distinction between plausibility and credibility. And one of the books I was reading, Dr. Douglas Grotius, he said, a plausible worldview is one that holds interest and appeal for a significant number of people at a particular time and place. So, for instance, Islam is plausible in Iran because there's a lot of people who find Islam interesting and appealing. While secular humanism is plausible here in the U.S. because a lot of people ascribe to that worldview. They're interested. They find it appealing. Plausibility, on the other hand, should not be confused with credibility, which deals with whether or not any claim is true and rational. Credibility. So whenever you say the word incredible, remember the movie The Incredibles? For some reason, they chose that name because their name literally means not believable. That's credibility means believability. How much believability does this worldview have? And Dr. Grotius goes on to say about credibility that the credibility of a worldview is determined by whether or not arguments marshaled in its favor are compelling and logically coherent. A worldview that is plausible is not necessarily credible. So all he's saying in that is if a bunch of people are ascribing to a certain worldview, so if you find a popular worldview, that does not mean that automatically it's true. So don't be afraid just because a bunch of people are pantheists or a bunch of people are atheists. Oh my gosh, thousands and thousands of people are atheists and pantheists. It must be true. No, don't get tied into that. Don't be fearful of that. Plausibility, a bunch of people think it's appealing, does not necessarily mean that it's believable. So I listed seven examples of worldviews that are in existence today. These are plausible worldviews because there's people that ascribe to these worldviews, but that does not necessarily make them credible. Now I want to move on to the big question. How can I tell if a worldview is true? And I would say there's about eight pieces of criteria that we can put against a worldview to discover whether or not it's really believable. Not whether it's true. Okay, there's some more things that you have to do, but these will give you a good idea of whether or not it's worth looking into, whether or not it's credible. Okay? And a lot of people may object to this. They're like, well, it really rubs me the wrong way. I don't want to view Christianity as some sort of science project or science experiment where I have to think of it as a hypothesis and run it under experiments and criteria and whatnot. It's my faith. Why would I want to do that? Well, think about it, guys. We put every one of our beliefs under the same criteria. A lot of the decisions that we make, we will put under these criteria. Does it make sense? Can I actually live it out? We'll talk about it. But don't be afraid, guys, of using the criteria for your faith. One, because we do it with every other area of our life. But two, remember, like I said, even you'll find this throughout the entire Bible. God was not afraid of being put to the test. From the Old Testament, when he raised up the prophets And he told the Israelites a lot of the times, I will do this so that they may know that I am the one true God. He gave them reasons to believe in him. And then in the New Testament, we see Paul and the other apostles giving good reasons for believing Christianity, believing that Jesus is the Messiah. In the same way, we're going to set forth 8 pieces of criteria to look at any worldview, including Christianity. And I think you'll find that Christianity does come out on top. So let's get started. Criteria, or criterion, number 1. The question that must be asked of a worldview, any worldview, is does it explain what it ought to explain? And what I mean by that is there are certain big questions about life that everyone on this earth will ask. Where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? What's after this life? Is there anything after this life? Does a worldview explain what it ought to explain? If it gives us no explanation for important aspects of life, like meaning, morality, and mortality, something is amiss. Something is amiss if a worldview refuses to even ask these sorts of questions or does not have an answer. And you know, sometimes, and you can't just chalk it up to mystery or it's a paradox. And I know Christians sometimes are guilty of this. It's like, hey, you know, Jehovah comes to your door and says, hey, you guys believe in the Trinity. We don't believe that's in the Bible. And we're like, well, the Trinity is just a mystery. Nobody can really understand it. Don't do that. This is not a good way to really show that your worldview is plausible and credible. You don't want to just chalk it up to mystery, because then what's to stop any other person from any other worldview from doing that? No, yo, yours can't be mystery. Mine can be mystery. No, we're not kindergartners. If a worldview asserts an essential proposition, X, and X is utterly mysterious or unintelligible and sheds no light on anything, then the assertion of X is a ration strike against that worldview. Don't say it's mysterious. Don't say it's paradoxical, stuff like that. But it must ask those important questions. Criterion number 2. The tagline here is internal logical consistency. Keyword being consistency. Internal logical consistency. What this means is that for any given worldview, are the essential elements, do they accord with one another without contradiction? For instance, if I wanted to start a religion or a worldview that said, you know, God is infinite, but then in one of my other essential claims about my worldview, I said, well, God is not infinite. He's finite. He's limited in his nature and power. That means that I have a problem. I'm basically contradicting myself. I'm saying God is one thing, and then I'm saying he's not the same thing. You can't have it both ways. That's a contradiction. So you have to have internal logical consistency. And one of the worldviews that fails this is panentheism. They really do claim that God is infinite, that the universe is infinite, but then somehow, since God is only limited to the universe, he's limited. So it fails on the front of it. Panentheism fails this criteria. So again, internal logical consistency, the essential elements, remember that. So Christianity, if you want to debate how you do baptism, that's not an essential element of the worldview. An essential element would be the nature of God and also the nature of mankind. Are we sinners from Adam, or do I become a sinner the first time I sin? That's essential. So I don't want to contradict these things. The third piece of criteria is coherence. Coherence. C-O-H-E-R-E-N-C-E. This is related to the second one, the consistency. But it actually just speaks in general about the essential elements, the essential beliefs of a worldview being tightly interrelated and conceptually linked. So do the essential elements actually make sense when you list them all? Do they link up with one another? Do they flow? Do they have a good flow, a progression of thought here? An example would be that... Take these two essential beliefs. God is a personal being who created humans in his image. So we have one that relates God and his relationship to human beings. We're created in his image. And how about the second one? It says that humans fell into sin against God, but God provided atonement through his own actions, through Jesus Christ. And so now we still have that relationship between God and human beings and our relationship. So the first one that I mentioned, that we're made in God's image, and then that relationship was broken. You can see a relationship there. They're conceptually linked. They're tightly woven together. There's a progression. But take this example. It's really overblown, exaggerated. Say my first belief is Jesus is Messiah. And then my second belief is that Barry Bonds from the San Francisco Giants took steroids. And my third belief is that JFK was assassinated by two gunmen. These elements do not relate to each other at all. On the face, they may have some plausibility. Maybe the two gunmen one. Maybe not. I don't know. But they might stand on their own. But for a worldview, it makes no sense that these would be essential. You know, they don't really intertwine. They don't relate to one another at all. So if you hear somebody saying, like, that's what you believe, they don't even relate. That's a good indication that their worldview is in shambles, okay? Coherence. The fourth piece of a criteria is factual adequacy. Factual adequacy. Sorry for the big words, but it just means that do the essential claims of a worldview match reality? So when I say the universe was created by God, can I, as a scientist, go and look into a telescope and do my calculations and figure out, did the universe have a beginning? Or is it eternal? Because if I believe that the universe was created, that means that once upon a time, it wasn't in existence. So there must be a beginning. Does it match up with reality? Factual adequacy. And this is where you are going to put your thinking cap on now, and you got to do a little bit of studying and look into the historical claims about each worldview or religion. And you can either do a historical experiment or maybe even a scientific kind of, in the scientific realm, you'll do experiments there. But you're just trying to figure out what claims do these worldviews make about reality, and do they match up with reality? Okay, for instance, who is it? One of the Eastern religions that believe that the universe sits atop the back of a turtle or something like that. I forget which religion it is, but yeah, Hinduism. Clearly, I've never seen the back of a turtle in any telescope, neither has any other astronomer. Clearly, this is bunk. So it doesn't bode well for Hinduism, okay? So factual adequacy. Pantheism, panentheism, atheism all failed this one. Criterion number 5 is existential viability, a.k.a. can I live it out? Can I actually live out this worldview? If it makes a claim about thou shalt do this, can I really do that or can I really not do that? Is it possible for me to actually do these things? And when you use the quote, or maybe you might hear the quote, well, this worldview just works for me. That does not cut it. That is not a good reason to hold a worldview. It works for me. It makes me feel good inside. It gives me the nice tickly butterfly feeling in my stomach. No. Works for me does not cut it. Does your worldview cause you to perpetually doublethink in order to live it out? For instance, when panentheism comes and says that evil or reality is an illusion, imagine, how do you live out the claim evil is an illusion? Whenever you see the horrible things happening in the news, or think about the Holocaust, can you actually say, yeah, that was just an illusion and it really didn't happen? Wow. Try telling that to the mothers, right? So you always have to redefine evil, you know, in some weird way. You have to double think all the time. And you have to actually go against your intuitive nature. Because you know when you see something evil happen, your gut just wrenches. And you know there's evil, but because of your worldview, you have to say, no, it's just an illusion. You got something wrong with your worldview. I sound like Jeff Foxworthy. You might be a redneck. All right. Criterion number 6, we're almost done here, guys, is intellectual and cultural creativity. intellectual and cultural creativity. This is an interesting one. It basically means that in your worldview, does your worldview inspire cultural and intellectual discovery, creativity, and productivity? And the reason is, this is a good question, because you have to think about it. When a worldview fits reality, when it matches up, it correlates to what really is, it should motivate its followers to embrace and master that reality with confidence and energy in every area of your life. For instance, I'm up here teaching you because I firmly believe that my worldview is sound, that I have good reasons. And that causes me to go and dig into the books and just think about these things long and hard. And it also, other Christian scientists, they let their worldview inform them. And they say, well, if God is God of the universe, he created it with order, not chaos, then I should see certain patterns arise in the universe. And then they go and do the math, and it causes intellectual discovery. Also, in the arts, you had great painters throughout history. You had great performances. You have great poets that have risen up that had a Christian worldview, and they wrote some of the most beautiful things, created some of the most beautiful art. If their worldview matches up with reality, it inspires you to go and master that reality and discover it and create and produce. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, let's again use a Holocaust example. A lot of people were inspired by Hitler's very anti-theistic worldview. Remember, guys, keep in mind that a worldview is not considered credible based on one of these criteria. They may fit two or three or even seven of the eight. That does not mean that it is credible. It just means that it has a higher probability. But to go and you say that just because the Germans were brainwashed and they were inspired to go and produce and discover things based on what Hitler taught them, is they're just satisfying one of the criteria. That is not enough. Okay? So yes, you will find these outliers, these outlier worldviews that satisfy one or two, but compared to other worldviews that satisfy all of them or seven, they don't match up. Okay? So don't be afraid if somebody brings up an objection like that. The seventh criteria is radical ad hoc readjustment.
Can you say that one more time?
Radical ad hoc, A-D space H-O-C, readjustment. And that just means that if somebody brings an objection to you, when your worldview is faced with a potentially defeating counter evidence, you know, when you, an adherent of that worldview may just redefine their claims, their beliefs. Like, oh, no, I didn't mean that. What I really meant is this. Does that make more sense? You know, when you have to really redefine your essential beliefs, when it's faced with evidence that or objections to it, then you got a problem, because then you no longer believe in what you used to believe. You're just creating an entirely new worldview, and you're just changing it to please, you know, because it just works for you. So we're talking about radical readjustment, okay, because it's the essential beliefs. For instance, karma, the belief about paying off your past sins, but and it also includes the rebirth. Well, in Hinduism or Buddhism, karma is being run, or originally it was just an impersonal force that was deciding what you became in the next life. There was really no rhyme or rhythm to it. But then somebody brought that up. I was like, how does an impersonal force decide anything? That doesn't make sense. And so then you had people within the past couple of centuries saying, oh, no, no, well, there's a lord over the karma machine, and that lord determines what you become in the next life. You're like, well, that's not what the ancient sources say. Why are you bringing that up? That's radical ad hoc readjustment. Okay? And this has even happened in Christian circles where when people were very fearful that they could not give good reasons about the resurrection of Jesus, the physical resurrection of Jesus, they would say, oh, well, Jesus just rose spiritually. How about that one? No, that doesn't match up with what the evidence says. So they just got afraid, you know, and try to readjust their beliefs, but it doesn't work. So Christians can be guilty of this too. The last piece of criteria, guys, is Simpler explanations are preferable to unnecessarily complex ones. Simpler explanations are preferable to unnecessarily complex ones. This is kind of like, I don't know if you ever heard of Occam's razors. You don't want to come up with more reasons than you need to. If one reason satisfies, you don't want to come up with two. It happens in math. When you can do something in two lines rather than 10 lines, you go with the two-line one. You want to save space. You want to make your teacher easy on the eyes, right? So simpler explanations are always preferred over more complex ones. This one comes a lot with when you come across a person who doesn't believe in miracles, or actually, say, atheism versus theism. When you believe that there is no God and matter is all there is, and I, as a theist, believe that there is a God, and therefore there is objective morality, there is objective truth. Well, I have a really good explanation, is that I have a morally perfect God, and he's unchanging in his nature, and therefore I believe that truth is unchanging. Truth is objective, and that morality is unchanging. Morality is objective. Whereas the atheist has to believe that everything is changing all the time. Therefore, truth is changing, morality is changing. And what's more is that the atheist cannot even account for how morality and truth came to be in the first place. They can't point to matter. Matter, you can't find a truth cell or a truth gene in anything, or a moral gene, a right or good or evil gene like that. There's nothing. They can't account. So I have a much simpler explanation, and it makes much more sense. Whereas they have their explanations, but they have to really sidestep the issues and come up with some crazy beliefs. I don't want to down them too much, but they have complex beliefs which sound plausible, but they just aren't credible in the end. How about that? Okay, remember, guys, I'll repeat this again, is that for any worldview to be considered credible, they have to not only satisfy all this criteria. When you satisfy all of this criteria, you're getting to a point where it's pretty credible, but that does not necessarily make it true. Okay, you're always going to be on the investigation. Okay, you really have to dig deep into some of these worldviews. But they also remember, it doesn't make sense to just satisfy one of the criteria and say, oh, mine wins. Nope, no, it doesn't. There's seven more, at least. Okay, so I think you guys should have filled out your handout by now. And what I just wanted to end with, guys, this study at least, is just an encouragement for you all. I really want to set the tone for this ministry and for the rest of the classes to come. And I just want to give you an encouragement about how to develop a well-trained mind. How to develop a well-trained mind. And there's three suggestions I have for you here. One is to become a lifelong learner. Become a lifelong learner, guys. This will enable you to navigate and interact with the ideas of the day and hold fast to what is true and good. When you're always learning, when you're always asking questions and trying to discover answers for yourself, this is just going to make you a much better thinker, a great learner, and you won't be afraid of any objections that come your way, because you'll have the confidence and the humility to say, you know what, I don't have an answer for you now, but I'm humble enough to go and search out the answer. And if it means that I have to change some of my beliefs, then I will. Become a lifelong learner. The second one is learn and practice the basic rules of reasoning, critical thinking, and logic. You know, because our culture today is really a bumper sticker culture. We're really set on slogans and just short, pithy sayings that really don't amount to much. Guys, don't become one of those people. Learn to really reason out your beliefs. Learn what you believe and learn why you believe. And learn how to reason well. Think critically about the really big questions in culture. Because I'm telling you, a lot of people have deep, deep questions. And when we cannot satisfy, when we cannot go and give good sounding answers and good credible answers, then we've not done our job. And as I mentioned, part of this ministry will be to do that in the coming months. The last one is seek integration in your knowledge. Basically, ask where what you're encountering and learning each day, ask how it fits and how it impacts part, the rest of the areas of your Christian worldview. If you call yourself a follower of Christ in this room tonight, everything that is influencing you, ask yourself, how is this influencing me? How does it fit with my worldview? Does it match up? Do I have contradictory beliefs? If so, do something about it. Change them. Go find answers. Always try to seek integration in your knowledge.